If you'll call the second case, please.
The court will now call ex parte Lopez Ahmed Nidi. Mr. Reagan, when you will argue for the appellant, Ms. Andrea Jacobs will argue for the state.
May it please the court. I actually agree with a lot of the things that are said in the state's brief. I think this case is a mess. I think Padilla has created a mess. I think the big picture issue that the court has to deal with here, and frankly, it was not directly litigated in this way, in the way that that Judge Gallagher resolved this case, is how does Padilla apply to pre-Padilla cases? We all know after 2010, when the Supreme Court handed down Padilla, as a criminal defense attorney, you know that now it's not good enough to stick with what was in the written admonishments for the last 30 years and to say, well, this may have an effect on your immigration status or it may not. I don't know. You have to give them some sort of advice. This has created, from a public policy standpoint, a huge mess. I mean, what do you do with an indigent defendant? Is an indigent defendant now entitled to a criminal lawyer and an appointed immigration lawyer when the criminal lawyer says, I don't know anything about immigration law? Me? I don't know. With the retained clients, it's a little bit easier. At least you can spread the money around with some other lawyers and go, okay, go hire this immigration lawyer and get him to tell you what to do. But it's a mess. Mr. McCarty, in this case, did what I think was probably a widespread practice at the time when he admonished Ms. Meemon. Now, that being said, I checked Westlaw before I walked in here today. Chiadez out of the Seventh Circuit is still pending in the Supreme Court on cert, which is going, Chiadez, I don't know procedurally how it's going to affect this case and other cases like it, because Chiadez is a federal conviction and it's federal 2254 habeas. And they're going to decide if Padilla was a new rule and whether it's retroactive on federal habeas for a federal conviction. De Los Reyes is still pending in the Court of Criminal Appeals as of today. That's the El Paso Court of Appeals case where they said that it was a new rule, it was retroactive, and De Los Reyes wins. And De Los Reyes is pretty factually similar to us. This is a case where I don't think there's a clear-cut answer to the big issue, which I really think is the procedural issue. I think the important thing to do when reviewing this is to read Padilla and you see how we got here. Before 2010, we had this whole idea of the distinction between direct consequences and collateral consequences of pleas. And basically what the law said was, you got to tell them about the direct consequences. You don't have to say a single word about an indirect consequence. Now, there were some cases that said you couldn't affirmatively mislead somebody about an indirect consequence, but you just didn't have to address it. And immigration was supposed to be an indirect consequence. And the reason immigration was an indirect consequence was because traditionally, immigration consequences weren't certain. And Padilla, Justice Stevens, I believe, did a really good job setting out the history of the immigration law in this country and how we had sort of this idea that even if there were supposed to be immigration consequences, there were all these waivers, and like the trial judge could issue a binding statement at the time of sentencing and say, I don't think this guy ought to get deported. And that was binding. Well, that went away in 1990. And then you had this sort of widespread, it's almost like clemency from the Attorney General's office, where they could give waivers. Well, that all got clamped down in 96. And what happened was, with the changes in the immigration law that culminating in 96, the law with regard to ineffective assistance of counsel and voluntariness of pleas didn't evolve with it until 2010. The other thing I think is important when you look at Padilla, they talk about, well, we're just going to analyze this under Strickland. I mean, that's ultimately what Padilla says, is we're just going to make this a Strickland case, and this whole idea of indirect consequences and direct consequences, that's out the window. We're just going to look at we're going to review it under Strickland. And under Strickland, they didn't go, what was the law in Kentucky at the time? They didn't say, what did the Kentucky Supreme Court say immigration would be? They looked at the ABA standards and the National Defenders Association standards and the NACDL standards. And those standards had evolved with the immigration law. And those standards, while, as the Supreme Court says, they're not mandatory, they were advisory, they said, if you're a criminal defense attorney, you better be advising people with immigration consequences as the immigration consequences of their pleas. And if you really think about it, Padilla and the lawyer who represented him in state court in Kentucky in 2006 or whenever that case came through is basically in the same position that Ms. Meemann is here. Now,
I have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
On page 9 of your brief, you say that although this is a deportable offense, the ultimate decision of the subject alien's deportation is left to the prosecutorial discretion of the Immigration Service. So that's the situation in this case. It's left to the discretion, the prosecutorial discretion of the Immigration Service.
Deportation, yes. Inadmissibility, no. And they're different.
Right. I got that from your brief. So you're saying in this case, it's not left to the discretion because it's inadmissibility. So basically, if she leaves, she's unable to come back into the country.
And it also means she can't adjust her status and means that she can't really do anything. She can't ever go back. She can't progress past where she was on this green card. And I think the law makes it pretty clear she can't get permanent lawful status with it. It is a direct consequence. And I wish I hadn't used the word deportability, because deportability isn't the right term anymore. It's now removable. You're either removable or you're inadmissible. And I think the law is pretty clear. She did become inadmissible in this case. I will say the state's brief raises this issue of the Attorney General waiver, and I thought I had an answer for that somewhere in the recesses of my research that I had done, not on this case, but on another one, and I couldn't find it. I'm going to ask the court to give me about 7 days, and I'm going to get some kind of brief together. I don't think the Attorney General waiver provision applies to her, and I think there's something in the INA that specifically says that she is not eligible for a waiver with a CMT, a crime of moral turpitude. The other thing,
that's fine. We would appreciate any additional briefing help in this case.
Why don't you set out specifically what you're going to brief so opposing counsel will know and can be doing her own response work?
It's in the
you'll
state.
You'll have 7 days to respond.
Yeah. It's in the state's brief where they say that it appears she's eligible for a waiver from the, she can apply for a waiver from the Attorney General. I have some other things I'll put in the brief about that too. But you know, you've really kind of hit on the nail on the head, and I think this is the chaos that Padilla has wrought. I don't know the difference between inadmissible and deportable or removable. I have no clue. I have to call an immigration lawyer and get him to tell me what the answer is. But that doesn't change the fact Padilla says what Padilla says. And in the big picture, while I am no fan of Padilla, I mean, Padilla makes my life a lot harder and scares me. I don't want to get found ineffective for doing something. On the other hand, I mean, who do we put the responsibility on? I mean, Ms. Meemann comes to this country in 2002. She owns a convenience store with her husband. They write some checks to, I think this is reflected in the record because it's in the indictment, to Costco for things that they're going to sell at their convenience store, and the checks bounce. She has two kids that she's putting through American schools who've never gone to school anywhere else, don't speak Hindi. They're effectively American children. She does not have the money to pay the $6,000 in restitution. She does not have the money to pay her attorney that she hired to represent her in the criminal case. And I mean, we say, well, she should have just, if she really thought this was an issue, she should have gone and hired an immigration lawyer. With what money? And how is she supposed to know what the rules are? And I think that is ultimately why the Supreme Court in Padilla said, it's on me. I got to go get an answer to the question.
Let me ask you this. Whether Padilla applies or doesn't apply, because this is a pre-Padilla case, doesn't the applicant still have the burden to prove a reasonable probability that except for this bad advice she received, she would not have pled guilty or that the results of the proceeding would have been different?
I think it's to prove that she would not have pled guilty, her affidavit clearly says she would not have pled guilty. And more than that, look at the facts and circumstances.
But wasn't that a fact issue for the judge to determine? And he apparently, from his findings, determined that she didn't meet her burden of proof on that.
I would say that the to the extent that his findings, and I don't have the findings in front of me, I've got to look. I thought he kind of danced around it to some extent and said that he, I don't know how I want to say this. I don't think that is directly the basis for finding that I don't think that's directly the basis upon which we lost in the trial court. And I think that the record is replete with evidence that shows she would have done something else. I mean, look at her situation. She obviously cared enough. She asked the lawyer, I do not want to do something that's going to jeopardize my immigration status. And she was obviously trying to accomplish some resolution of this, wouldn't she? She signed an agreement with the DA's office before she even had a lawyer to try and pay the restitution. She couldn't pay it. And then she had her lawyer go out and try and work out another agreement with him to pay the restitution and make the case go away. And she couldn't pay it. She was obviously trying to get this resolved in such a way that it would not affect her immigration status. And I think that circumstantially shows that the result would have been different.
Realistically, what could she have done differently after she got the bad advice or the lack of advice?
Demand a jury trial. Try a check case. How are they going to prove who walked in there and signed the check?
When the risks were then, at that point, if convicted, she would be removable or deportable or whatever the term that you want to use, as opposed to just inadmissible.
Well,
if she was convicted.
Deferred is convicted for immigration purposes.
If she was correct.
So whether she's convicted by, whether she stands up and says not guilty and gets convicted by a jury, or whether she pleads no contest and the judge enters does deferred adjudication, she is convicted for immigration purposes. So the immigration consequence of having a jury trial is nil. The real consequence is you're looking at 180 days to 2 days, 2 years in a state jail. She's got no prior criminal record. Is she really going to get sent to state jail over that, or is she going to get a straight probation? I mean, the immigration consequence of having a jury trial is nil. Now, you layer on top of this what we do know from the record. Her lawyer had filed a motion to withdraw because she couldn't pay him. I don't think this is a clear-cut case one way or the other. It's a mess. And it's a mess for the lawyer who, like I said, there is no doubt that what Mr. McCarty, if Strickland means what everybody else was doing at the time, then we don't get past Strickland, because this is what everybody else was doing at the time. But that's what the position Padilla was in too. Ultimately, I think the real procedural issue in this case is Padilla going to be retroactive? And like I said, that is bouncing around. It's set out in the state's brief, and it is. It's bouncing around in the Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. And I don't think we're going to know the answers right away. I'll reserve anything else for rebuttal unless anybody has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Ms. Jacobs?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Andrea Jacobs, and I'm here on behalf of the state, the appellee in this matter. Before I get into my arguments, I just wanted to throw out a couple things. For purposes of aggravated felony, a sentence is a conviction. She doesn't have an aggravated felony because of the deferred adjudication. I don't have that particular statute in front of me, but I do know that there is case law about that, how for aggravated felony, deferred adjudication is different. And so if she was convicted at trial and she received a one-year sentence or more, she would have an aggravated felony, which would make her deportable. Now she's inadmissible because she has a crime of moral turpitude and not an aggravated felony. And regarding the facts in the case and the trial court's findings, the trial court did specifically find that she failed to prove that a plea of not guilty would have been rational under the circumstances, even though she did say in her affidavit that, you know, she would not have pled. That he said, in light of the evidence, you know, she, it's just not, it's inconsistent with her actions and with what happened. The trial court should be affirmed for three reasons. First, that Padilla should not apply in this case because this is a pre-Padilla case. Second, because even if a Padilla were to apply, the law in this case is not succinct and straightforward. And third, that she has failed to demonstrate that her pleading of guilty would have been rational under the circumstances, so that her plea of guilty, that she would not have pled guilty, would have been rational. This court should find that in Texas, the prevailing norms prior to Padilla was that a defense attorney did not advise on the immigration consequences. I mean, that just was the standard. We have case law up to at least 2008 that I can confirm, where the cases, the courts have repeatedly held, you know, it's not ineffective, there's no constitutional requirement for this admonishment. We've got a Court of Criminal Appeals case in 1999 saying, yeah, it might be better, but we can't find any constitutional reason why this admonishment would be would make this required. And so because of that, we have attorneys who before Padilla were told, they, you know, in Texas, they didn't have a duty to do this. Now, I don't know what Kentucky, I don't know what they were said in Kentucky. I know that in Padilla and the cases that talk about Padilla, they talk about how the lower courts had said that since 1995, defense attorneys were doing this. Defense attorneys were advising. And so it was a prevailing norm because the lower courts were saying you should do this. And there was some requirement of advice on immigration consequences. In Texas, that's not been the case. In Texas, it's been clear. I mean, no, you know, it's no muddling around that it's not constitutionally required and you're not ineffective if you fail to say this. So with that in mind, this court should find that, you know, the prevailing norms in Texas have been that that a defense attorney does not advise on the immigration consequences, especially, excuse me, in 2009, before Padilla came down. Strickland required that you evaluate from the counsel's perspective at the time. And at the time that Mr. McCarty represented her in 2009, all he had was this case law and a Fifth Circuit case law that repeatedly said, you don't have to do this. So in light of Strickland, you know, Padilla should not apply. And to say that, well, Padilla does apply would fly in the face of Strickland repeatedly holding, you know, in all the cases, his progeny, everything, that we look at the time, hindsight's 2020, but we don't consider that. We just look at the time of the representation. And here we are looking at the time of the representation. Defense attorneys, you know, they weren't advising on immigration consequences, and case law was saying you don't have to. For these reasons, this court should find that Padilla doesn't apply to this case because it is a pre-Padilla case, and that the prevailing norms in Texas were that we didn't do this. Regarding the issue of the trial court's findings were proper because the information about immigration, not succinct and straightforward. I understand that appellant argues that, yes, if you look at this statute on inadmissibility, it's succinct and straightforward. It's just as clear as the deportation consequence. Well, Padilla did say that immigration law can be complex, and it is a legal specialty of its own. When the law is not succinct and straightforward, a criminal defense attorney need do no more, than advise a non-citizen client that pending criminal charges may carry a risk of adverse immigration consequences. Now, as we know, in Padilla, they held, well, it's the law in this case is succinct and straightforward. Well, he was deportable. You go to the deportability statute, you look at the list, and there it is. He was deportable. That was succinct and straightforward. That's not this case. Appellant is not automatically deportable in this case. And even if you go to the deportability statute and you look at the list, it talks about crimes against moral turpitude and it requires two. So a criminal defense attorney will look at the deportability statute and go, huh, she's not deportable, and move on. Appellant argues that she is inadmissible, but how would a defense know to check that? She's already here. When you think of admissibility, you think of coming in or getting visas. And I understand that she makes claims that, you know, she wanted to get her visa and everything, but there's really not a permanent residency, excuse me. There's no in the admissibility statute about that other than this is for people eligible for admission and visa, which kind of implies it's for people first coming in. So how would a defense attorney know that this would apply to someone who's already been here for many years, you know, who is a business owner, who has children, and, you know, that one, I mean, there's just no way to know based on, you know, okay, here's the immigration statute, good luck. I mean, how much are we expecting our defense attorneys to know? This law is not succinct and straightforward. Appellant argues that she must prove admissibility to prove her permanent residency. But how is a criminal defense attorney supposed to know that? She comes in and says, well, I want to become a permanent resident. What do I got to do? He's going to say, go talk to the immigration lawyer. I don't know. Now they're saying, no, no, you should have known. You had to check the inadmissibility statute to see if this case would apply. The law's not succinct and straightforward on this. In addition, and as counsel spoke about, the admissibility statute has a waiver provision. I don't know if she applies. I'm not an immigration lawyer. And as he said, you know, he needs some time to argue and to brief it for you. My point is not that she was eligible for the waiver. My point is that that waiver is in place, and defense counsel didn't know. And how was he supposed to know? He's not an immigration lawyer. So there are things in place that show that this is just not succinct and straightforward. The admissibility statute itself, it may be clear. It may be clear that, yes, we know crime of moral turpitude is going to make her inadmissible. But what does that mean for this client? It, you know, it was clear, but it wasn't clear as to how it applied to her. The trial court then properly found that the law was not succinct and straightforward in this case when finding that the attorney's representation was proper. Finally, the issue of prejudice and harm. Padilla talks about, you know, the first prong of Strickland and then remanded it back. And as we now know, Padilla was ultimately, his conviction was vacated on appeal. That, you know, that case was over September 28, 2012. Well, in this case, we're talking about harm. Well, the Supreme Court didn't even get to harm in Padilla. Here, you know, she's failed to demonstrate that a plea of guilty would have been rational under the circumstances. As we said, if she was convicted at trial, she would become an aggravated felon and would have been automatically deportable. And when she was advised about the immigration consequences and that she should, that there would be immigration issues and that she should contact the immigration attorney, she didn't do so. Now, I understand there may be monetary issues. That didn't come up in the writ. That wasn't discussed in the writ, that she couldn't afford it. You know, McCarty didn't say anything about that. He just said, you know, I don't know the answer. You need to go to an immigration lawyer, which is perfectly acceptable, was acceptable before Padilla, because we don't know immigration law. When the judge advised her that she could be deported, she still chose to plead guilty. These aren't instances that show that she was very concerned that she was going to be deported. Mr. McCarty, in his affidavit, he said, well, she didn't have a viable defense, and she didn't want to go to trial, and there was a high likelihood that she would have been convicted. Again, because she'd be an aggravated felon if convicted, well, let's look at it. She didn't have a defense. She didn't want to go to trial. In light of that, would it have been rational to go to trial knowing you're going to be convicted and the possibility that you're going to be an aggravated felon and become automatically deportable? Except for now, she's inadmissible and even says that there's no guarantee that the government will actually move to deport her. So she could be here, and I know there's something about the immigration status and things like that, but in her own brief, they talk about how the fact is, you know, she may never be deported. The government may never go after her. So would she really take the risk of becoming automatically deportable when right now there's no guarantee she's going to be deported? If she had a defense, if there was evidence, if she, you know, likely she wouldn't be convicted at trial, well, that was not ever presented or alleged in the trial. So the trial court properly found that she failed to meet her burden. It's her burden here. You know, that she failed to meet her burden that she would not have been convicted. Her burden would have been that it would have been rational under the circumstances for her not to plead guilty. And the trial court properly found, no, she failed to prove that. Therefore, unless the court has any questions, okay. Well, for premises considered, the state prays that this court affirm the lower court's decision to deny the application for habeas corpus because the ruling is clearly within the zone of reasonable disagreement and is based on supported by the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs.
Just briefly, the issue about the money is all over the record. I mean, it's in Mr. McCarty's affidavit. He sets out exactly what happened. She had worked out a deal with the state to pay it off, couldn't pay it off. I went and got him to give her a deal to dismiss it if she paid it off. She couldn't pay it off. She also hadn't paid me. I filed a motion to withdraw, and I agreed to try and settle the case for her if we could just end it. I mean, that's what it says. I don't really have much else. This case is a mess, and Padilla is a mess. And I mean, you can tell by reading the opinions; they're all over the place. I mean, if you look what's going on across the country, there's courts are going like this as to what's going to happen. I think Padilla is going to be retroactive. I just, without Padilla itself on its facts, if it applied to him, it's going to apply going forward. And I think it would, if it applied to him, I can't figure out a reasonable basis to say it didn't apply to somebody else tried at the same time he was. If the court doesn't have any other questions, we ask you to reverse and send this back to Judge Gallagher.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs. We thank you for appearing before us today and for your arguments in this case. Your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business. We will be in recess for till 3 o'clock for our 3 o'clock docket.